obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Magdalena, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I want to thank all of you for being here this afternoon, and Kathy for asking me to speak, Trina for hosting me, Lars Singh for giving out my name, and everybody. This is such a great honor. I have had so much fun since I got here, so thank you so much for the great opportunity to be here. I am from Mexico, Ensenada, Baja California, not too far from here. And that's where my strong accent comes from. It doesn't go away. I've been here for a long time. But I live in Seattle. My home group is a Rent on Thursday Night. It's the oldest group in the state of Washington. We are as old as Al-Anon. So if you're ever in our area, please come and visit us. We'd love to have you. We are like any other group, disorganized. But we strive to do our very best. What it was like and what happened and how it is today. Like I said, I am from Mexico. The first alcoholic that I met was my father. My father's still drinking until this day. For some reason, he hasn't been blessed enough to be sober, but that's okay. I am the oldest of six sisters, and my father wanted a boy, you know. He never had the opportunity, at least not with my mom. And so when I was born, because he really wanted a boy, he named me after his father. His name was Magdaleno, so they just changed to the O to an A, and I was named after my grandfather. But nobody ever talked about my grandfather, and I asked my my mom, how come nobody talks about my grandfather? And she said, well, because he was crazy. And I said, well, what was wrong with him? And so she told me that he drank too much, you know, and that's what the problem was. Nobody talked to him about him because he was crazy. And I said, well, tell me more about him. And so she told me that they didn't know what to do with the alcoholic or with my grandfather at that time, that they built a box in the backyard, and they stuck my grandfather in there. And they had a little door like this, and they fed him through that little door, you know. And so when my father was about 8 or 9 years old, he started bringing alcohol to his father. And so by the time my parents met, around 15, 16 years old, my father was already an alcoholic. And I like to believe that that was the method of curing alcoholism back in those days in Mexico, just building a box in the backyard. So my father is that kind of a violent alcoholic. Because he always wanted a boy. Every time my mom had a girl, he would say, oh, another prostitute. So I grew up thinking that I was a prostitute. And then I asked my mom, Mom, what's a prostitute? And she said, well, you know when we go to the bar and wait for your dad outside? And she said, you know those women that are outside smoking cigarettes? Those are prostitutes. Then I thought, you know, I'm 6 years old. I don't look anything like them, but I must be because my father said I was. And so I grew up thinking that I was a prostitute. And then I went to a church. You know, my mom told me that I needed to go to church. And in this church, Mary Magdalene was a bad woman. So here I am, I'm a bad woman. I'm a prostitute. I have always been tall and thin for some reason, always, you know, since I was a little girl. And most kids in Mexico are short and chubby, you know, they're cute. And here I am tall and skinny. And so kids didn't want to play with me. My dad is that kind of alcoholic. Like I said, that he's a violent alcoholic. And so in the morning, he used to get up and tell me, Larguchona, which means something ugly and long. Really doesn't mean anything. It's something ugly and long. And so I was ugly and long. And so he would say, Larguchona, go get me a bottle of tequila. So I would go to the liquor store about, like I said, 6, 7, 8 years old. And in Mexico, you can buy tequila when you're a kid. And so I remember going to the liquor store, getting him this big bottle of tequila. I knew all the names, all the brands and everything. And so I would go to the liquor store and come back. And on my way back, I remember thinking, you know, I can't remember the last time I had milk. And all we eat at home is beans and tortillas every single day. So when I got home, I would go tell my father, you know, I can't remember the last time I had milk. And my dad's a baker, that's what he does for a living, and we didn't even have bread in the house. All we had is beans and tortillas. So I will tell him that. I had no problem telling my father that we had nothing to eat. So I will say, you know, I can remember the last time I had milk, but you're having tequila. And my father had a problem with that. And so he will pull out this little leather belt, just whip it out of his pants and just hit me with the belt and hit me. And I remember going to school with I would protect myself. And I remember having belt marks all over my body, and I would go to school like that. And because, like I said, in Mexico, the kids are cute and short and chubby, and here I'm tall, skinny, all beat up, and the kids didn't want to play with me, and they would say, we don't want to play with you. Look at you. And your dad beat you up again. And they would say, and you smell like beans. And I did, because we didn't even have a toothbrush. And so nobody wanted to play with me. I think at age 8, I started contemplating suicide. And I read something in a magazine. And so my self-esteem was pretty low. And I just... some of the kids in the neighborhood didn't want to play with me. They said, you know, that I look like a dog, and then I would look at myself in the mirror, and I had a dog back then, and I looked at the dog's lips and my lips, and we kind of look alike, and I started barking at myself and believing, you know, that I was whatever somebody told me I was. I became whatever somebody told me I was. So my dad didn't believe that women should go to school, so I was not even allowed to go to school. I used to sneak out of the house to go to school, and then I would go to school, and I stayed back in third grade 3 times because, see, I couldn't understand anything. I would try to read the letters, and the words would dance in front of me, and I try, but I just, you know, my mind will go back. Am I going to have something to eat today? Am I going to get beat up? What time? Is my dad going to come home and you know, be the monster that he is? And so I didn't learn anything. And so I was tall, stupid. I was a prostitute. And all those tapes stayed with me until I got to Al-Anon. You know, how do you get rid of those tapes? Well, you tell a child, that child becomes. And so without working on step 2, you know, asking God to return us to sanity. Our literature talks about that, you know, that the alcoholic is only saying how he feels, but I didn't know that back then. And so I remember another thing that my dad would do. He would tell me in the morning, Larguchona, get up and sweep the floor. And I would look at my father, I just wanted to kill him. I remember I hated my father so much. And I remember looking at him and saying, why, it's a dirt floor. It didn't make sense to me, you know. And so he would do the same thing and beat me up. And, you know, that was normal. I started doing yoga. I became this great yoga teacher. I was a kid, and I was teaching adults. And I became vegetarian really young in life. And my father thought that was witchcraft, so I was not allowed to go. But I would sneak out of the house. And my father kept having affairs. You know, my dad is about 5'4", maybe 5'5". He's got a big belly, a big head, and he's ugly. You know, he's really ugly. And my mom's tall, she's gorgeous, she's light complexion. I thought just my mom was so beautiful, and I thought, what is she doing with him? You know, he's so ugly. But she just kept having kids. She said that if she took the pill back in those days, it was considered a sin and she could go to hell. You know, she didn't know that she was already in hell. You know, she just didn't know. But she didn't believe me when I told her anyway. So looking at my four-step inventory, it's so easy to blame the alcoholic, not knowing that that we had a part to do in it too. And I always thought I had this horrible life, you know, but looking at my inventory, I've noticed that I had these wonderful grandparents. I love my grandparents. You know, I think their mission in life was to love me. My grandparents loved me. And I remember going to my grandma's house, and my grandma will make tortillas, and then she will give me a tortilla, and I will put butter on it, a flour tortilla, and then I will eat it. And I just love talking with my grandma. We used to sing and skip and everything. And then I will go next room, and there was my grandfather. And my grandfather was the greatest guy. I thought he was just so smart. He would tell me that he traveled places. He would read these books to me. I love my grandfather, and I will sit on his laps, and then he will read stories. And then once he was done, he will tell me to clean the seeds out of the marijuana, you know, and they're all the joints for him. And so then he will light up a joint, and he say, "Here, you want to take a hit?" And then I will say, "Oh no, Grandpa, that stinks," you know. Then my grandpa would talk to me in Japanese and Chinese. You know, I just thought he was so smart. But it took me a while, you know, I had been in Al-Anon about 5 years, when I realized that my grandpa was high when he was talking to me in Japanese. But I still love my grandparents. And so one day my father came home and told my mom, "You know, I'm seeing a younger woman, and you know that I don't love you, and she's pregnant, and you need to leave and take your 5 kids with you." And not knowing what to do, my mom started looking for work, and, you know, looking for work. She was in her middle 20s at that time, and she had 5 kids with a 6th grade education, and there's no jobs in Mexico. Who was gonna hire her? And I remember going around with her trying to, you know, see who will hire her, and nobody will. So she said, "You know, there's a job in the U.S. Can you stay and take care of your sisters?" And I was 15 years old, and I said, "Yes, Mom, I can take care of my sister." So I became my sister's stepmother. You know, I was a horrible sister. I was very angry, very angry. If my dad hit me, I hit my sisters. And I remember I used to go to church, and I would tell the father, "Well, my father hit me, so I hit my sisters, and I did this, and I said bad words." And the priest would just say, "You know, get on your knees and pray." And that didn't help. I was still angry. So I didn't believe there was a God. If there was a God, he was a punishing God. But my mom came. So she came to the U.S. to work, and I became my sister's mother. And she started working as a nanny in somebody's house and started sending money, and we were able to eat a little better then. My father's alcoholism progressed, and this is what happens in the family home when somebody's drinking. My father stopped looking at us like we were his daughters and started looking at us like we were women, and he started touching my sisters in an inappropriate way and started spying on me when I was getting undressed, and I knew something was gonna happen, and I just hated this guy. I just hated him. His father had left him a machete, and every once in a while when we had nothing to eat, we had to cook outside, and We had no electricity, no water. Toilet was outside. And my father would feel bad, I think. He would pull out this machete and go outside and put it on his stomach, in his big belly, you know? So I thought it's going to take a while before he reaches. But anyways, my mom would say, go see what your father is doing. And so I would go really quiet, you know, and not make any noise, make sure, you know, that he stabbed himself. I thought if he killed himself, life would be so much better without the alcoholic around. But he's still alive, so that didn't happen. And so my mom moved to the U.S., and when I saw that, I wrote to my mom, and I said, Mom, this is what's going on. My father's doing this to my sisters. And my mom said, well, if you want to come and live with me in the U.S. and help me bring your sisters, we can do that. So I came to the U.S., and I did like most Mexicans do. I jumped the fence and came to work illegally. And I went to work in the chicken farm. I don't know if you guys been in San Marcos area, but there was there's a university or college there now. But back in those days, used to be a chicken farm, a big, great, big chicken farm. So I used to work there. I was hired to work there as a farm worker. And I used to give shots to the chickens. And once in a while, when immigration came and tried to take all the illegal aliens back to Mexico, some of them will run up the hill, and I will hide. And in these chicken farms, you know, there's like rows and rows and rows of chickens. Well, in every box, there's about 20 chickens, and under the chickens, there's a chicken poop. Well, a lot of us illegal aliens will hide in the chicken poop. And I was one of the ones that hid in the chicken poop. I was 15 years old, and I had a lot of acne. And I remember hiding in the chicken poop. And there was a lot of worms, a lot of bugs, and they will stick to your skin. And then the chicken poop, I don't know if you ever touched any, but it's really creamy. And I would just stay there until I didn't hear any noise, and I would come out and try to clean myself off, you know, and hope that I could go back to my mom, because, see, I was 15 years old. And once in a while, immigration will kick me back, and I would jump the fence and come back again. And if I, you know, I remember standing by the borderline, looking at both sides. And if I didn't see the border patrol officers, I will run and run and run to the other side. And when I didn't get arrested, I will go back and do it over again. See, I am addicted to excitement. I just love excitement. Even until this date. But you know what? There is a place for all of us in Al-Anon. And that is service. You know, I got so involved with service that, you know, today it fills every pore of my being. You know, I feel good when I go to sleep. I am so exhausted of all the things that I have done, and I go to sleep, and I don't wake up until the alarm wakes me up. So, if anybody has problems with insomnia, get involved in service, and that will help you. I'm sure Kim knows all about that, right? Anyway, so one day I was 15 years old, and I told my mom, Mom, I want to go to school. I don't have any friends, and I don't speak the language. Can I go to school? And she said, sure you can, but you can't stop working. So I went to school, and that's where I saw the most gorgeous guy in the universe. There he was. He was tall, he had long hair, he was thin, he was light complexion. And you know, in Mexico, the darker we are, the lower class you are. Or it was when I lived there, you know. Not much changes, I don't think. But anyway, so I was pretty dark. But you know what happens? I live in Seattle now, so we get light. I'm so grateful for the sun. my granddaughter is here with us, and we want to visit our, my sisters. And her cousins were asking her, why are you so white? It's like, well, we don't get much of the sun over there. But anyways, so I saw him. And when I saw him, it was like the world stopped. I felt in love with this guy, and he was just so gorgeous. And I looked at him, and then I looked at me, and I said, he'll never look at me. You know, and all those tapes started playing in my head. I'm so dark, I'm stupid, I'm a prostitute, I should not be going to school, you know, I look like a dog, and all those things, and too tall, too skinny, and you know, I thought he'll never look at me. But our Al-Anon literature in the One Day at a Time, it also talks about that anything we let go, it has our claw marks on it. So I wasn't gonna let him go easily, you know. So I started flirting with him, but he didn't know I was flirting with him, because this guy has had a lot of friends. He was very attractive, and when wherever he walked, all these guys followed him. And so every time he went by, I remember hiding, and I had this one friend now, and I remember hiding behind a wall and every time he went by, I would throw kisses at him and then hide and push my friend so he would think it was her. But he realized it was me. And one day I was at the park, and there he was, you know, with all of his friends. And he was just so gorgeous. And he called me over, and I went. And after we introduced ourselves, he said, would you like to go to a concert with me? And I thought in my head, I wonder what that is, you know. I said, sure. And it was 1975, and Bad Company was playing in San Diego. And so he came and picked me up, and I got to sit next to him, and he had a little Nova. And because he had a lot of friends, I looked in the back seat of the car, and there was a lot of people back there. They were piled on top of each other. And then I thought, gosh, I wonder how they fit in there, you know. But they were all in there, and so I didn't care. I sat next to him, and he put this 8-track player in the stereo, and this loud music of rock and roll came out. And I had never listened to English music, you know. And so I got like, oh my gosh, this is so modern. And they started smoking pot, you know. And I remember taking a deep breath and was back on my grandfather's laps. You know, I felt the love of my grandfather. and that joint went in front of me, and then I said, no, thank you. But I thought, you know, if you need help, I can roll in for you. Because, you know, I had a lot of years of experience. You know. But it was our first day, so I didn't want to be so pushy, you know, so. We dated for 2 years, and in these 2 years, he tried to kill me a couple of times because he was high on acid. And then I thought, you know, when we get married, he's just going to stop drinking, you know, he's going to stop drinking. And I would think, you know, this poor guy, he drinks because his mom abandoned him in Mexico when he was a little boy, and he grew up on the streets, but all he needs is love, you know, all he needs is love, and I'm just going to love him so much that he's going to stop drinking. But of course that didn't happen. You know, I also thought, when we get married, we're going to live in a nice home in Rancho Bernardo. I don't know how I was thinking these things, you know. But anyways, I really thought that we would live in Rancho Bernardo, and we're going to play tennis in the weekend, and we're going to have 2 nice low riders park outside. But the reality, we never had a low rider, and we never lived in Rancho Bernardo. And his alcoholism progressed where we barely had a car. One time I remember as I was pregnant and I had my daughter in front of me and my husband was driving and we were in a motorcycle. And I couldn't believe that, you know. But before that, you know, I told him, you know, I'm pregnant. And he said, you don't have to marry me, because that's what we did in 1977. You know, we got married. And I said, you don't need to marry me. And he said, you're crazy, we're getting married. So we got married, and we had this beautiful daughter. And she was just the most gorgeous kid in the universe, you know. She was part of him and I. And I just loved this little girl. I loved her. And we named her Mirabella, which means look at the beauty. And I remember looking at my granddaughter, and she was just so gorgeous. And I told her, nobody's going to hurt you like I've been hurt. I'm just going to love you and protect you, and you're going to have a good life. And you know, I meant it. I just wanted my daughter to have the best. But see, I didn't know that alcoholism is a family disease. And living with an alcoholic, I had become sick too. And I did my very best to be the best mother I could be, but my concentration was on what the alcoholic was doing or not doing and how to prevent him from doing whatever he was doing. And by this time, my sisters were in the U.S. They had come to the U.S. and they started their disease of alcoholism. And they were not using drugs, and some of my sisters had become gang members, and they were involved in really bad stuff. Some of them had married alcoholics, and they were being beat up at home. And the only one that I thought would give me some happiness was my husband, and he was so into his disease. He was in and out of jail. And I started reacting, you know. I remember standing by the door, waiting for him. I will just call his mom, his friends, the jail, the hospital. I call everybody, and nobody wanted to talk to me. And I remember standing by the door and just waiting for him, and he will not come home. And I remember wearing something sexy, you know. Maybe I could keep him at home that way. And he will not come home. And I remember him coming home at 3-4 in the morning, and I was so upset. I was so angry that I would go to the kitchen door and grab a knife and just wait for him. And then when he walked in, I just wanted to kill him, you know. I just wanted to kill him. And we always lived in the neighborhoods where other alcoholics or addicts live, other gang members lived, and the other dangerous people will come up the stairs because we lived in the second floor, and they would go, Magdalena, leave him alone. And then I was armed with this knife, and I would say, if you don't leave right now, I'm going to kill you too. And I will cook good meals, not cook good meals. I will hit him, not hit him. You know, I will bail him out of jail, not bail him out of jail. I just did everything that I could to make him stop drinking, and nothing worked. Nothing worked, and I started falling into this loneliness. Because, see, people like me, or many of us members of Al-Anons, I run out of people, you know. I bothered everybody. I wanted to fix everybody nobody wanted to talk to me. And I had no friends. My sisters were in their own world. My mom was now dating a drug addict. And between my mom and the boyfriend were now selling drugs to my husband. Now my husband and my grandfather were getting high together. And it's just, I just didn't know where to go, you know. So I thought, I'm going to have a boy, you know. I'm going to have a boy, and he's going to stop drinking. And I had a boy, you know. I couldn't believe I had a boy. And I made the same promise to him, and I named him Carlos after my husband. And you think because somebody names after their son after you, you will stop drinking, right? That's... But that didn't work. And I made the same promise to this little boy and of course, soon after that, I forgot the promise. And I remember my husband and I used to get into these big fist fights and my kids would come out of the room running and wanted me to stop. And I would grab my kids and just throw them in the room. And I was so angry and I didn't know what to do with it. And one day, I started shoplifting with him because he was shoplifting in order to pay for his drugs. He was now using heroin and drinking at the same time. And I started shoplifting with him because, after all, he needed a supportive wife. And I married him in the good and the bad, you know. So there was not any good, but, you know, I thought it's got to come be there somewhere, you know. So anyways, I was so fortunate because God had another plan for me. I never got arrested, but I could have been arrested because I had my kids with me when I went shoplifting with him. And one day the judge told him, you go to treatment or you go to prison. And he said, I'll go to treatment. And that's when I was introduced to Al-Anon. And I remember going to my first meeting and sitting there and looking at everybody, and everybody looked so beautiful. And I was so much less than all of you.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
And I sat there and they said, would you like to share? Then I said, I want to know. I told them if I should allow my husband to drink. Because see, he's not an alcoholic, he's an addict. And this really nice lady looked at me and she tapped me on the shoulder and said, dear, keep coming back. And I never came back. You know, I didn't come back because I thought I was better than, you know, the false pride that some of us have and that somebody read in the Understanding Ourselves and Alcoholism, the false pride. You know, I was married to this hard dude who was in prison. My sisters were gang members and they had nice low riders. The false pride, you know. And life got worse. Life got worse, and I decided now I was working in a factory, and I was working 12 hours a day to be able to pay for the alcoholic to bail him out of jail. And I told my husband, you know, life is hard here. Why don't we move back to Mexico and come to work every day? I was still an illegal alien. But I had learned a little bit of English where I could cross the border and say that I was a U.S. citizen. And so we did that. You know, he just wanted me to leave him alone. And so every morning I would drive 120, I don't know how many miles is from Escondido to Tijuana, or not from Vista to Tijuana, because I worked in San Marcos, he worked in Vista. And so every day we drove all those miles in order to get him away from his friends, because I thought the problem was his friends. But he got new friends in Mexico, and there I was, left alone. So I started taking karate classes. You know what's bad? I started taking karate classes, and every time he walked in the house, you know, he would, because I had now gained some kind of serenity, I thought, you know, I would lay in bed, you know, just wait for him. And as soon as he walked into the house, into the bedroom, I would jump and go, ah! Ah! And he just wanted to go to sleep, you know. But he had to go through me every day, you know. So that didn't work. He continued to drink. And one day, I was driving this 120, I don't know how many miles a day, back to Mexico. And I had the moment of clarity. You know, I had the moment of clarity. And I looked at him. He relapsed after treatment. And I looked at him in the passenger seat, and this time I didn't care for him. I no longer cared for him. I knew there was nothing I could do. I had run out of ideas. I just didn't know what else to do. And then I looked in the back seat of the car, and I saw two kids there. And my kids had the saddest look on their eyes. You know, their hair was long. They were super thin. They had teared the upholstery down from the car. And then it was the first time that I saw my kids, and I thought, what happened? How did I get here? What happened to the promise that I gave to those kids that I was going to love them and care for them? And in that moment, I thought, what do I do now? What can I do? And I remember going to my first Al-Anon meeting. And prior to that, you know, I didn't know what to do. You know, I thought, I can't go to church because they'll make me pray it, and that doesn't help me. I tried that, you know. Then I thought, if I go to a counselor, they don't see people like me. I thought only people that were seen by counselors were those who had boogers coming out of their nose and saliva. And I looked at myself, and there was no boogers or saliva coming out of my face. So I didn't belong there. So one day I put my kids in the back seat of the car, and I was driving. And I was driving over 100 miles an hour, and I just wanted to die because there was no way out. There was nowhere to go. And I asked God, if you exist, if you're up there, please help me stop because I just wanted to die. And then my husband went to treatment. And so on this day where I didn't know what to do, I remember Al-Anon. And I remember I went in an Alano club. It's an Alano club, and they had the slogans, the steps, the traditions, you know, concepts. And I remember looking at the slogan, first things first, and, you know, and keep coming back. I remember that. And then I thought, you know, what's first right now? It's my kids. And in that moment, I made that decision to move back into the U.S. and go back to Al-Anon. And this time, I didn't care what my husband did. He went to prison, and I went back to Al-Anon, and at this time I was ready to do anything the program told me to do. So I heard, get a sponsor, come to meetings, stay in contact, do service, and read the literature. You know, so I did everything, because this time I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. And I remember going to my first meeting, And it was 1984, and I was sitting there. I was shaking. I was so cold, but it was an internal cold because my soul was cold. I was so afraid, and it was nothing in this world happens by mistake, as we all know it. And I went to the meeting, and it was a large meeting in a small room. So I got to sit next to two people, and I remember sitting there. I had holes on my jeans. My hair was in my face. My husband used to cut my hair while he was drunk. And that's how I came to Al-Anon, and I was shaking. But you know, the people that were next to me, they were so nice, and their shoulders were touching my shoulders. And my soul started getting warm. And I started feeling the love, you know, the energy in the room. And I felt that I was safe. And I just stayed there. And I just felt so grateful, so, so grateful. On my third meeting, I went up to this guy, and I asked him if he will be my sponsor. And I asked Ralph to be my sponsor because every time somebody shared, he listened. He looked at that person. You know, Ralph is still my sponsor until this day. We've been together for 28 years, and I had the great honor and opportunity to sit next to him on a Thursday. I went to an Al-Anon meeting, and we were sitting right next to each other. And Ralph still looks at the person when they're sharing. He still does that. So I asked Ralph if he will be my sponsor. See, what happens in the alcoholic homes, everybody speaks a different language. And I used to try to figure out, why is the alcoholic laughing? It's not funny. Whatever he said is not funny. And I learned in Al-Anon that we speak a different language. You know, the alcoholic is talking about one thing, I'm talking about another. Nobody understands each other. But in Al-Anon, people did, you know. And so I got there, and then after the meeting, I went up to Ralph and I said, Ralph, can you be my sponsor? See, and I didn't speak English. I understood more than I could speak. And I remember sitting there they said, would you like to share? And I said, I like to, but I can't speak English. See, my home group has the unconditional love that we so much talk about in our meetings. They didn't care how I looked, whether I was dressed appropriately or not. I was welcome into the home group. And so Ralph, you know, he didn't care where I came from, whether I spoke the language or not. Ralph looked at me, and see, I didn't know that Ralph was from England, and Ralph has this strong English accent, and here I am from Mexico, I can't speak English. And Ralph looked at me, he said, we'll give it a try. So Ralph and I started getting together 3 times a week, and Ralph started taking me through the steps, step one, step two, you know, step three. And I learned that God loves me. And I started going through step four. And I started bringing the kids to the meetings that I had with Ralph. Because, see, I learned that my kids were not safe with my sisters. Because my kids used to come home with cigarette burn marks in their arms, and then I thought, my sisters are not doing that. They can't be doing that. They love my daughter. They love my kids. But see, it was no longer my sisters. The disease had taken over. And so I learned that I couldn't leave my kids. They could not be trusted with them. So I started bringing the kids to the park, and Ralph and I met together and did the steps, and then I went and I said, Ralph, I'm not a good mother. I am not a good daughter. You know, I don't like myself. I'm tall, I'm skinny, I'm stupid. I should not have gone to school, and blah, blah, blah. You know, all those tapes. And he said, Magdalena, stop. He says, you are a child of God, and you are not to judge anybody, and that includes you. He said, see that bird up there? And then I said, yes, it was a crow. And he said, what do you think of the bird? I said, I think it's beautiful. He said, do you think the bird gets up in the morning and says, it looks in the mirror and says, you're so dark, you know, your feathers are out of place? I said, no. He said, that bird gets up in the morning and goes and does God's will. He goes and looks for food for the kids and comes home and feeds the kids. That's God's will. You just got to do God's will. Besides, you are a child of God, and you are never to call yourself any names again. So I do what my sponsor tells me. I am a very good sponsee. I don't know if I'm a good sponsor, but I know I'm a good sponsee. And so I remember I stopped doing that. And I remember I have always enjoyed exercising. So I remember going for a run and thinking, you know, every time somebody passed me, I would say, God, you're so slow. Look at the guy passed you again. You're so stupid. But my sponsor told me I couldn't do that. So I let him go, and every time somebody passed me, I would go, pretty woman running down the street. I changed the way of thinking, you know, little by little. I was allowed to do service. I was given the great honor to be the coffee person. I was just so grateful. I became a part of you, not a side, but I became a part of you. There was no Spanish meetings in Escondido at that time, so I started Spanish meetings. There was no Latin meetings, so I started meetings in English and in Spanish. I was just so busy that when the alcoholic got out of jail, he was on his own. I had to go open the meeting. And kids were now in Alatin. Life was great, and the world was getting together. It was the 1990 International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous in Seattle. And I told my husband, you know, a lot of our friends are going. Why can't we go? And he said, we can go. Nobody's stopping us. So we pull out the kids out of the SCAC convention, the Alatin convention that I think is going on this weekend. We went and got the kids out of the convention and drove to Seattle. And we, at this time, now, you know, what happens when we stop bailing the alcoholic out of jail? There's money. So we were able to buy a home, a trailer, you know, a boat. All the dreams that we had, they were becoming real. And so we went to Seattle, and we had never seen, you know, such a beautiful mountains or the trees or the river. And we just felt in love with Seattle. And after that convention, I told my husband, you know, we should move here. He said, we can. Nobody's stopping us. And so 6 months later, we sold everything and moved to Seattle. And I remember going to the Al-Anon Intergroup office because, see, I learned that I can't keep it unless I give it away. And I didn't want to give anything away. My life had become so rich, you know, so rich. And so I went to the intergroup office and I asked him, do you have anything for me to do? I need to do service. And she said, well, gosh, keep coming back so we can get to know you better. And soon, you know, they needed an Alatin coordinator for the intergroup office. And I had been the Alatin coordinator in the San Diego area. And so I had experience with that. And they allowed me to be the intergroup coordinator or Alatin coordinator. And I was just so honored and so honored. And there was my husband, he still has that attraction to people, and people just follow him. They just follow him. There was only one AA meeting in Spanish that met once a week. And so he said, this is not enough for me. I need more meetings. So he got together with another person, and they started an AA meeting. And the meeting, they started meeting every day. Then what he does of service, he builds up a group and gets everybody in service. He's a great manipulator. You know, he gets everybody in service. And then he leaves the group and goes and helps another, starts another group and then starts another one. And people just follow him because he's got that attraction. You know, sometimes when I'm having a bad date and it's like, I'm so mad at him because he's eating the cereal wrong, you know, and now we have that in our literature. I wonder what alcoholics see on him because I want what they have, you know. So anyways, I got involved in service. My husband got involved in service. Kids went to Alatin. There was no Spanish meeting, so I got involved in that. And I just got busy, busy, busy. And I was working as a waitress at a Denny's restaurant. And one day we realized that our daughter was coming home. Even though she was going to Alatin meetings, she was coming home with, she had black marks under her eyes, baggy eyes, and then she had bruises on her skin. And we thought, what is wrong with her? She's going to Alatin. You know, this kid was so involved in Alatin in service that she was speaking in Alaska. She was speaking everywhere, but there was something wrong. And we realized that she was drinking. And we offered her to take her to treatment, and she went to treatment and started drinking again. And she went to another treatment and started drinking again. And she just, you know, we had to ask her to leave because we still had the little boy in the house. And she would come home and tell our son, you know, if you don't drink with me, you're not a man. And because she was not practicing the unity of the home, my husband and I had to ask her to leave. Because, see, we needed to stay together because unity makes the strength. And I knew that, you know, that she was in God's hands, you know. In Al-Anon, we also talk about putting our kids or our loved ones in the palms of God. So I grabbed my daughter, I put her in a nice blanket, and she was in the hands of God. She can't be in better hands, you know. She's in the hands of God. Whether she was going to live or die, she was in the hands of God. And that's all, you know. And so every once in a while, she will come home and ask for help. And we thought she was going to die because, see, this kid grew up in Alateen, in the program. She was 6 years old when my husband and I got into the program. So she knew all the slogans. She knew the right words to say, everything. She was killing herself. And one day she comes home and says, Mom, I want to go to treatment again. And this was her fourth treatment. And then I said, no, don't go to treatment. You go to AA, work the steps, get a sponsor, and you're going to be okay because I trust that Alcoholics Anonymous works. I trust you, and I trust you with my daughter. And she looked at me, and she was drunk. She got really close to me, and when she spoke, she smelled just like my dad. You know, that still alcohol that I hated. I hated for so many years. Now my daughter smelled like that. And I said, okay, we'll take you. She said, Mom, don't you understand I can't stop drinking? And you know, it's hard to understand that this is the, you know, I love how Jennifer explains it and how Charlie explains it and you know, many others. I just love how alcoholics explain it so I can try to understand it. But anyways, I said, I don't, I'm sorry. She said, I need to go to treatment. So in a November, cold November day, my husband and I put our daughter in the back seat of the car, like she was our child, you know, she was our baby. We wrapped her in a blanket and took her to treatment. And she was our baby. And so we took her to Spokane, Washington. It's about 6 hours away, maybe longer. It was a snowy day. And we took her to a program, and this was a long-term program. In that program, they took her to a Native American meeting. The Native American meeting needed a coffee person. She became the coffee person, and today, by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, she has 18 years of sobriety. I'm just so grateful. So grateful for the willingness of the alcoholic to leave his home and open the door. So when my daughter needed help, the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous was open. Today, you know, she got married and she gave into the guy of her dreams, and they gave birth to my granddaughter Solana. And Solana Beach was her favorite place to go when she was a teenager in Alateen. So she named her daughter Solana. Unfortunately, her husband relapsed. And after 2 years, she had to leave him. And you know what happened? She told him, you know, I love you, but I love my sobriety and my daughter more than you. And she walked out just like that. You know, she did not need to take karate classes. Take him out of jail. Nothing. My sponsor told me, Magdalena, without an education, you're not going to do anything in life. And I said, Ralph, but you know I'm stupid. I can learn. Ralph said, no, you're not. You need to go back to school. So I went back to school, and in 1999, I graduated with a 4-year college degree. Before that, my sponsor told me to do a resume of my job. I had been a housekeeper, you know, dishwasher, you know, a farm worker, everything. Today, I work for the Washington State Department of Corrections. I'm a parole officer. I send people to AA. And I know when they lie to me. We still have that little boy in the house, you know, that after 10 years of Alatin, he said, Mom, I'm cured now. I'm normal. I said, okay, if you don't want to go to Alatin, that's fine. You don't have to. When he was in high school, he had this girlfriend, and when they broke up, he gained custody of this cat. You know, I hate cats. So he brought the cat home. And one day I was having an Al-Anon relapse, you know, and I was going to his room to make sure it was clean, you know. It's his room. Come on, he's in high school. What am I doing in his room? That's an outside issue. Tradition 10 talks about an outside issue. It's his room. My gosh. So I looked at his room and I put a nasty note. I wrote a nasty note. I said, if you don't clean your room, I'm going to throw your cat away. And so he wrote me another nasty note back. Said, Mom, I'm cleaning my room one day at a time. So, so I'm not all the way done yet, you know. So he put that triangle with that circle, and he put AA Allen on. Keep coming back, it works. So when he went away to the university, I got stuck taking care of the cat. You know, today, the cat, you know, I was so smart. I introduced him to the outside world. He likes his freedom. Now, Tommy is his name. He's still around. You know, he comes and visits, but, you know, he enjoys his wildlife. Today, my son is drinking, you know. But, you know, he knows the principles of the program, and he knows that wherever he goes, there you are, you know. He knows AA and Al-Anon is all over the world because he has traveled enough with us. And he's in the hands of God. You know, again, there's no better arms than the arms of God. He's got a great job. He travels on his vacations all over the world, all over. And I like to believe that, you know, he's got this confidence on him that he's going to be okay, you know, and he is. He's just this great kid. Our daughter Mary again, and on Tuesday she gave birth to a little boy, and she's just so happy. That's why our granddaughter came with us. Let's see, Carlos and I, you know, we started this journey. The power of God. You see these two losers getting married? You know, and then God has a plan for everything. And today, Carlos and I, last month, we celebrated 35 years of marriage. And I'm just so grateful. The journey in recovery. God knows what he's doing, you know. We don't. My job can be dangerous at times. Most of the time it's pretty dangerous. We go into dark homes, you know. I supervise felony offenders. And when a lot of them have weapons and they have their alcohol and the drugs, and they don't like you. You know, alcoholics don't like it when we take their drugs away, you know, or alcohol. So I call Ralph and I say, Ralph, you know, my job is dangerous, and there is an opportunity for me to be armed. I like to be armed. But in order to be armed, I need to pass this psychological evaluation. And I don't know if I'll pass it because, you know, I'm kind of crazy. And Ralph said, Magdalena, if God wants you to have a gun, you'll have a gun, you know. So today I'm an armed officer. I call my sisters, I have a gun, I have a gun. Is your husband going to be okay, you know? Unfortunately, none of them have reached recovery, but they're doing the best they can. and they're in God's hands too. Today, I'm still involved in service. I am the delegate for the state of Washington. I am just so grateful for the life that I have today. You know, it's a life that I never imagined existed, and I owe it all to you and to God. Thank you so much for having us here. God bless you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.